Welcome back to another sci-fi episode where psychology and finances collide. Today, we're going to be talking about Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. This is a book that was written by Elizabeth Dunn and Michael Norton. Wonderful book that I had the opportunity to read and used it as the entire theme for the financial symposium that occurred on the 25th of March, 2025. And so I created some mini classes as a result of reading through the chapters. And I got some feedback, and I'll share some of that feedback from the respondents or the attendees. We had 438 people register for the financial symposium, and we had 420 attend. 107 were in person, and the remaining 313 were online, and there were 27 hybrid in between those numbers. So in the classes, I kicked it off by examining how we think, feel, and behave with money as it regards to spending. And my class title was Spending, What's in Your Petri Dish? And that's from the play on words from the Capital One commercial, What's in Your Wallet? Now, of course, I'm promoting spending cash, not credit. And what I love about this book is it's helping folks understand that you don't have to buy into the belief that more money equates to more happiness. This book and I disagree with the culture at large believing that more money buys more happiness. So the book and I agree that true happiness comes not from increasing your income, but from using the money you already have with increased wisdom. Figuring out how to do that on your own can be overwhelming. So I like to think of this as you attending a class, and as the book says, you can try and do this, but it would be like you trying to perform your own surgery. So I'm going to be your money surgeon today. I'm going to be the expert that's helping you use your current resources to unlock greater happiness. So the first thing that Happy Money jumps into is the concept of buying experiences and not just things. And I love this because it has its own chapter. We have so much stuff. And at the symposium, we invited two attorneys to speak on two different estate planning classes, one on digital assets and one on wills versus trusts. And one of the attorneys that I was speaking with, she was talking about how so many folks come into her office and they talk about how many years they've spent acquiring stuff, acquiring things, and now in their estate planning, they're trying to figure out how to get rid of this stuff or these things. And so part of this book is about reminding folks that if we only purchase things, that we will run out of, it will lose its luster, we'll experience buyer's remorse, we'll have comparison issues, those things will eventually depreciate, their short-term value in the things, we'll experience fear of better offer, and all around, it's just a fleeting appeal with material possessions, which is like that stuff. But with an experience, it's going to be very different. An experience becomes better with time. It's unique and personal. We get to reminisce about these experiences later in life. There's appreciation value that goes with that. It's not going to depreciate over time, but that experience appreciates over time, especially if you think of those in the elderly communities where those experiences, those memories continue to appreciate and not depreciate. And for many folks, that's the only thing they have to their name or to their memory are those experiences that they've had in life. And then, of course, long-term value with an experience. And then memorable appeal as well. So one of the things I brought up in the symposium is the misnomer with purchasing a house. And I like the experiment that they talked about in Happy Money, where not really experiment, but the research they did on home buyers and what their true satisfaction was. So they found in this research that while a new house provides a temporary boost in subjective well-being, it doesn't create lasting happiness. While movers' satisfaction with their houses increased substantially, their satisfaction with their lives, their overall happiness, didn't improve at all. So when we think about the house satisfaction that was there, but with the life satisfaction that continued to go missing. So true contentment comes from changing our habits and our mindsets and not just our surroundings. And I talk about folks that come in for purchasing a new home, and we have that conversation about, will the budget allow for it, and will they have the ability to maintain the home? And usually we measure that by how much savings they will have set aside after the purchase of the home. And a lot of folks simply do not have the necessary savings to be comfortable in purchasing a home. So we just talk about it just not being their season, and then maybe putting that off while they're continuing to build that savings to be more comfortable and for the home purchase to make more sense. So one of the things we get into is if you purchase the home itself could become an added stressor where you thought the home would make you happier. The home, in fact, is making you more stressed. And there comes a whole litany of negative emotions with that when you're not able to continue meeting your financial obligations because now the home is eating into all of your other line items within your budget or your spend plan. So I want to take this a step further and burst your bubble that owning a home will not increase your happiness. There was another research study that they did that owning a home, they think, is often considered a path to happiness and financial security. That's what a lot of folks will say in the individual session. Well, I want to purchase this home because I want to have financial security. This is something that I will have as an asset that I get to add to my net worth statement. But does it really bring security at all? Not really. Research is showing that homeowners aren't actually happier than renters. While buying a house can be a good financial investment for some, it doesn't translate into a good happiness investment. And here's a quote right out of the book. If the largest material purchase most of us will ever make provides no detectable benefit for our overall happiness, then it may be time to rethink our fundamental assumptions about how we use money, end quote. This quote is basically summing up what many financial experts have been saying for years, in that if our home, one of the bigger purchases that we'll ever make in our lives, is not bringing us any iota of overall or additional happiness, then why aren't we rethinking our smaller purchases? So here's another thing. A lot of folks, and I watch a lot of HGTV, and I see the cluttered homes and why people want to move out. But this really grabbed my attention, this quote in the book, that the importance of social connection also helps to explain why moving to a nicer house often fails to enhance happiness. Fancier houses may not make you any happier unless they have nicer people inside them, end quote. And I love that quote because a lot of folks are wanting that house because they think it's going to fix a problem, fix a problem in the marriage, fix a problem with their kids. If I can only provide them their own room or teen hangout, or if we finally get the pool, that's going to fix the relationships within our home. No, we are putting way too much pressure on an inanimate object to bring us happiness, which will never have the ability to ever bring us true happiness. It's the relationships themselves and the connection that is found within that relationship that's going to heal those family dynamics. So, further talk about connection, psychologists continue to say, and you've heard this in my other podcasts, that if you ever want to increase your subjective well-being, which is their clinical term for happiness, the best way to do that is to increase connection. So we really need to think about what we're actually doing with our money and how we are spending it. And I like this quote, and I'll read you an excerpt from Happy Money. It is found on page 5. Think of purchases you've made with the goal of increasing your own happiness. Consider one purchase that was a material thing, a tangible object that you could keep, like a piece of jewelry or furniture, some clothing or a gadget. Now think about a purchase you made that gave you a life experience, perhaps a trip, a concert, or a special meal. If you're like most people, remembering the experience brings to mind friends and family, sights and smells. Which of these purchases made you happier? Let me ask that question again. Which of these purchases made you happier? And continuing on, faced with this question, some 57% of Americans reported that the experiential purchase made them happier than the material purchase, while only 34% reported the opposite. So I think that's just such a great way to sum up how experiences are going to have a greater appeal in the long run than material possessions themselves. And the authors use this wonderful example in the book about equating purchases to arcades and kids that go to, say, a place like Chuck E. Cheese, and they get caught up in getting the tickets, which is considered a material possession, right? Because the tickets will purchase that green sticky frog or the sticky hand or the candy or other things. I'm sure all the parents are out there laughing right now thinking of all the stress that that creates for your family, just standing and waiting for your toddler or your child to choose something already so that you can go home. So they use that as an example because children, they get caught up in the pursuit of the material rewards at the expense of potentially more enjoyable experiences, playing the games themselves. So the worthless rubber frog, as it's referred to in the book, serves as a reminder that material prizes often hold fleeting appeal and end up forgotten or discarded. And usually, as the authors say, that's on the floor of the van, the family van, with all the crumbs of whatever the kids were eating that day, and never again will they even play with it. So it's the same concept. We all have a child living within us somewhere where we get caught up in that reward system of, I just want to get more stuff, but that doesn't make us happier. The experience itself does. So next time you go to Chuck E. Cheese or you go to someplace, and probably I shouldn't be naming these companies out loud, but if you think of any place where you can go and play arcades with your kids, you probably want to help steer them towards connection with you. Hey, can we play some games together? Can we make some kind of new reward system from those tickets and create a little family competition, which does create that level of connection, that whole experience where you will drop some coin just to buy the tokens to play the arcades. Then it's something that's worth all of your time and effort. So there's a famous strawberry story that they talk about in Happy Money as well. And so we talked in the symposium about how to make these strawberries as transcendent as this experience that one of the authors experienced at a restaurant, where the chef turned this one strawberry into a full course. I think it was a 5-course meal that he served, and the strawberry itself was one of those 5 courses. And you might think, oh my goodness, how could this even be something that I would pay for? But according to the author's experience, it was absolutely transcendent. I gave a strawberry mint to the audience, and I asked them to not only get rid of the mint as often as we do. We put something in our mouth like a Tic Tac or piece of gum and we chew it or we enjoy it for a while. And then before we know it, that whole experience is over. And it's the same thing with spending money. And this is what the authors wanted to get at. So I asked them to think of their positive association, the best possible memory tied to that mint, which really turns to the power of association. So I got them thinking about it. And as this author says, when he bit into the strawberry, it was soaked, first of all, in gin and tonic. He could taste that first. And then he could taste the barbecue sauce. And then the strawberry itself. And then a full myriad of associations enveloped him, where it took him to a summer barbecue. So the strawberry experience truly did become transcendent. And the renowned chef says that his goal is to turn eating into an experience that supersedes eating. And that became my goal. After reading this book, I thought, wow, how could I turn this financial symposium into a transcendent experience where I get to help them turn earning, spending, saving, and giving into an experience that supersedes earning, spending, saving, and giving. And after the experiment, we did have a discussion, and folks did increase what we call, and what Happy Money Book calls, the drool factor. And we'll get that in a moment. So here's the biggest bang for your buck with an experience, if you use your money to buy an experience rather than a material good. You'll get the biggest bang when that experience provides opportunity for connection, has memorable moment potential, is tightly knit into your values, and I've provided several episodes in the podcast on that, tying your values to your goals, and when the experience is unique, offering no comparison to other options. Then the authors get into making a complete buying experience a treat, or making anything that we want to purchase a treat. So abundance, they say, is the enemy of appreciation. And the best way, or the best ally then, is scarcity. So they quote, from chocolate bars to luxury cars, habituation represents a fundamental barrier to deriving lasting pleasure from our purchases. And so I'll tell you a little bit about habituation. I talked about this in affective forecasting and how we are poor predictors of predicting how we're going to feel when we finally receive something. We tap into what we call our pleasure habituation, where if you were given ice cream every single day at the beginning, you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. This is going to be great. But then by the end of the 30 days, you're tapped out. I don't want any more. I'm getting sick of thinking of this. That's that pleasure habituation. We simply start to associate the thing that we were excited about with nothing pleasurable. It's just as pleasurable as picking up an old pen and just writing something on a piece of paper. It's lost all appeal. So that's what happens if we continue to go and buy our favorite coffee every single day. It no longer is a treat for us, and it might even become a cumbersome event where we start resenting whomever or whatever if we don't get it. Or if we receive it and it wasn't the full experience that we hoped for. So we somewhat become purchase snobs and we become a little spoiled, so to speak. So the best way to do that is to make things more scarce for ourselves. So they talk about, and here's a quote, the more we're exposed to something, the more its impact diminishes, end quote. And they talk about the problem with that habituation, but it's also a problem with adaptation because humans, we adapt eventually to everything that we have. So if you grew up poor, you adapted to being poor and not having the ability to purchase things. If you are rich, and we're talking glittering rich, then you also adapt to being able to purchase whatever your heart desires. But as we see in the news time and time again, money does not buy happiness. And in fact, if there's no connection at all, a lot of folks, including celebrities and folks with endless resources, end up taking their own lives. So, and the Happy Money authors actually have something to say about that later on as well. But instead, they want to steer our attention to marketing efforts that help us to appreciate the things that we do not get to have day after day. So, for example, pumpkin spice. That comes out every fall and usually goes away after Christmas. So we go from January all the way to August without our pumpkin spice. So it really does become a treat when fall comes around. Same concept with candy corn. And have you ever had candy corn? I love it, but only for a month. I get sick of it within a couple weeks. But by the time it comes out again, I'm excited to have it. And it's the same thing with the McRib or the Disney Vault. I mean, we could go on and on. So the authors say, and here's a quote, temporarily giving up chocolate can restore our ability to enjoy it. So what I would like you to do is to think of, if it's not chocolate, just insert the word there. Temporarily giving up X can restore my ability to enjoy it. So that's just something I thought was interesting. And the authors do caution that while simply consuming less isn't a guaranteed path to happiness, research does suggest that changing how we consume can lead to greater happiness for less money. So let me emphasize the correct word, that changing how we consume can lead to greater happiness for less money. Even small adjustments to our spending habits can make a significant difference. And actually, that's the whole portion of my financial counseling session using solution-focused therapy, is focusing on what one small change can you make a big difference. Then they go into the concept of scarcity and how scarcity, again, is our biggest ally. Scarcity can amplify our happiness and promote growth, but abundance or overabundance can tap that pleasure habituation center of our brain. It decreases appreciation and leads to overindulgence. And I shared the story with the financial symposium attendees. I shared the story of when I was younger, I used to play softball in a cornfield, and we only had two softballs. And we loved hitting the ball, we loved running the ball, we loved catching the ball. But because we only had two softballs, we were scarce with supplies. And so that led to promoting growth for us because we had to run for those balls. We had to track where the ball was even going when we hit it high into the sky. We had to see where it landed so that we could go and retrieve it later. Isn't that the same thing that we want to do with our finances? To at least know that this income is scarce enough to where we can appreciate that we need to track where it's going so that we don't end up losing it later? Boy, what a notion, right? To track your money and think of your money as scarce rather than having a never-ending supply. And I'll tell you, these days, I think people are being shaken up a little bit. No longer are you completely secure as a DOD civilian or a federal civilian. You could lose your job like anyone else in the private sector. Again, what a notion. So we start treating our jobs even as something that is sacred, as something that is scarce, and maybe we become more productive, and maybe we become more attuned to what we're actually doing. And that's all we want our clients to do. All of the financial experts, all the financial counselors, we just want them to have a better relationship with their money. And the only way to do that is understanding what it is, where it's going, and what it's doing for us. And this is what this entire book is trying to do for us here. We're at 26 minutes, so I don't want to burden you with too long of a podcast. So in the next episode, I'll continue with the review of the book Happy Money and what we discovered in the Financial Symposium. Thank you. And please remember to rate us wherever you listen to the pod, especially if you found this information helpful.